now Erica Gomez. She's professor from the Autonomous University in Mexico City. Her topic is angiogenesis and metastasis in breast cancer.
The title of her talk is Cracks in the Wall. In order to can, we must know. We give the word to Dr. Gomez. Thank you very much for the invitation. Good evening to everybody. Don't worry, I won't talk about tumor angiogenesis. Okay, you know, many of us were put in a pickle where we were invited and told, we want you to talk about sciences against the wall. It was a pickle, because I had no idea what to say. And well, I opted for talking about something which is very specific about our work in science that has to do especially with knowledge and with how knowledge is shared. Science has many characteristics. Many of them have been described in these talks. I want to talk about a triad. About the triad: knowledge generation, transmission of knowledge, usage of knowledge, which in my opinion is a triad which is not a one-directional cycle, but as it is shown in this scheme here, it's related among the three in both ways. That's to say, for example, we generate knowledge and we transmit it. I'll talk about that a bit more in detail, how we transmit knowledge. But it's not that simple. We generate it, we transmit it. No, because when we transmit knowledge, receivers of this transmission of knowledge give it back, and they generate more knowledge. In my opinion, if this doesn't happen, we cannot even talk about science. Now, once knowledge is transmitted, not necessarily in an automatic way, this knowledge is used. And again, usage per se goes, on the one hand, to modify the transmission of knowledge, to generate a new transmission of knowledge, and on the other hand, it will also generate knowledge itself. Then, this triad, which I think is very important, for me, it is central in science. I also have a strong vocation for teaching, so for me this is crucial. Therefore, this also strengthens what the doctor was saying about that for me, science, either it's collective or it isn't. It does not exist if it's not collective. And I want to share a phrase that when I was doing my PhD, it didn't open my eyes. I already knew it, but it put words what I was suffering in that moment, which was being in a lab where I could not talk to anybody because nobody was interested in what I was doing. And this is the idea. Knowledge, due to its nature, needs to be communicated, written, explained, realized. Just as grass, ideas search for light, they love crowds. It grows better when you step on it. So that's what I wanted, to have my ideas being stepped on. And that's why I think this is so important. Okay, so I'll talk briefly how, from my area, which is biology, specifically cellular biology, biomolecular stuff, how do we transmit knowledge? I'm not going to complain. I will tell you just how it is. Okay. Here you see one person, a scientist wearing a robe, although I never really wear a lab coat. And really, this is not a person. It's usually groups of people that after finishing some aspect, some small aspect of a project, they decide that it's ready to be communicated. So they write what we call an article. Afterwards, at least in my case, I guess I've been lucky after this crisis. After you write the article, you comment it. You comment it with peers, with the lab, or sometimes with the department in which you work, etc. And this enriches the article. After once you consider, okay, it's ready to be published, or at least to be sent to a journal, and you select the appropriate journal. Before, this was easier than today, let's say. I'll tell you later why this is. Once you choose the adequate journal, because of the topic, basically because of the topic, and let's say, not exactly the quality, but if you do what I say, what I call small science or large science, that also decides which journal you're going to send your paper to. After this, you send this to the journal, you communicate to the editor of the journal, and with new technologies, one submits it electronically. Afterwards, the editor sends our manuscript to other researchers, our peers, that is to say, researchers from our specific area, of the specific area of the article, in order to do what we call peer review. After these peers review the article, they give their comments to the editor, and the editor, not by phone, we know that, gives it back to the research group, and the research group discusses the recommendations of the reviewers, if they need to make changes, if they need to perform new experiments, they make adjustments if necessary, or you argue about the observations that were made and give them back to the editor. And the editor, in principle, decides whether this article is published or not. Even though there is a peer review, the editor can make a decision. It's not binding, his decision. The peer review is not binding. We assume that the peer review is the most important part of the process, but it's not a binding process. So, in the end, the article is published. Okay, so then I have told you more or less how knowledge is transmitted from my area. But who receives it? Well, the fact is that it's received basically by people who are within academic institutions. They are the ones who receive this information. Other researchers, if one's lucky, teachers and students. But basically it reaches other researchers. This, up to a few years ago, had a huge wall, which was the paying wall. Editorials, mainly large editorials, which group an important number of journals who publish our works, well, they charge for reading these articles. Before internet, they were selling subscriptions, they were selling printed magazines, and after internet, they sell electronic magazines. This generates a wall and differences. It's not the same to do research in Harvard than to do it in the Autonomous University of Mexico City. And not to say to do it in a university in Burkina Faso. The wall is way taller there. This paywall, at least for researchers that we know from this place, very well-known place now, Sci-Hub. Okay, this has solved this problem more or less. Alexandra Elvakian, a girl from Kazakhstan, when it was still the Soviet Union, during her PhD, she had the idea that she could not pay for all the articles that she needed to write her PhD thesis. She just couldn't pay for this. So she pirated them. And thanks to her experience, it occurred to her to create Sci-Hub, which is a website in which one can obtain basically any article that you want and that you cannot pay for. As I say, this solves the paywall, mainly for researchers. Researchers before Sci-Hub, we found our ways. Well, I don't know, but well, I know. Editorials really don't like Sci-Hub. They have sued them, their trials. They take it down, but they know that 3 days later it will be back up in the network. Before we did something, we wrote to a friend in a different university and he would forward you the article and we would still not pay for it. I don't know almost anybody who pays for reading an article. Well, this is a map where we indicate, with respect to the size of the circle, the number of users, the number of users of Sci-Hub in different countries. In first place, it's China. Iran. Iran, then China, India, Russia. Russia is a big user too. But as you can see, Europe and the United States are also big users. So in practically any place where there is research being done, Sci-Hub has been used. That's it. Okay, this has worked for the objective that this girl had. That's to say, so that researchers and students had access to information, to scientific information. However, this is not enough. And I will tell you then of another way of public communication of science, which we call open access. Open access, briefly, very briefly, is the immediate and unrestricted access to academic documents. By unrestricted, we understand that there is no paying or legal or technological restrictions. Open access, or the word, the term, was used for the first time at the beginning of 21st century. And it was used above all by something that has been defined by 3 B's. Budapest Initiative of Open Access, Declaration for Open Access Publication, and the Berlin Declaration of Free Access to Scientific Literature. I will talk briefly about each one of them. The Budapest Initiative of Open Access was published in February 2002. It was a meeting of 16 people in which it was a very heterogeneous group. There were representatives of editorials, of online editorials that have open access, like Biomed Central. But there were also representatives from universities, mainly from Canadian universities, and it was organized by what now is the Foundation for Open Society, who is financed by George Soros. And well, that implies its critiques, but okay. The point is that they got together and they said, okay, they had in mind publications which were peer-reviewed, which are the vast majority of publications that we use in order to communicate our results. So what they said was that open access, so this unrestricted access, universal and unrestricted to knowledge, to academic knowledge, should be using technologies. That's to say, there was already internet, and it became an immediate need to have unrestricted access to scientific information. So they had two options, what they call self-archive or direct access journals. So they said that at least them were committing to propagate this idea and to generate that they and their colleagues would start to publish their works either in self-archive public repositories or only in free access journals. When I discovered this, this was a big surprise because I knew of the existence of open access. Let's say I know about it almost since the beginning, since 2000. But at least in my circle, publishing in open access was like, well, if you can't publish anywhere else, then just pay for publishing. Why? Well, because in order for a journal to be open and unrestricted, expenses are covered in a different way, not by the reader. So then in general, the expenses are covered by paying a fee for publishing. So in all the groups that I was involved with, they were saying, okay, I'm not going to pay for publishing. It's not like I need it. So we'll keep publishing in non-open access, the ones we've always published in. Afterwards, in 2003, there was a Bethesda declaration about open access publications. In this, there were a couple steps forward. Here they started to think about how to organize, for example, public repositories, which clearly these repositories should be managed by academic institutions or by academic societies or by government agencies, right? And also it's included that in this open access unrestricted there can be works that are derived from the published materials. This group was more broad. The Howard Hughes Foundation was the one who organized this, and many education institutions participated, mainly North America. Although, again, other interested agents participated. And the third B is the Berlin Declaration for Free Access to Scientific Literature. Here, they put the emphasis, although it was very clear from the beginning, they stressed this, that they are for the distribution and free usage and respect to authorship that is not lost. And to make long-term repositories by academic institutions or government agencies. These three B's were very important to the growth of this open access. This Berlin Declaration is very important because more than 120 academic institutions from all the world participated, and more organizations have joined. For next year, there are 500 universities that are signing this declaration, so they're committed to open access of the works that they generate, that their researchers generate. Well, I'm almost done. So, yes or no? let's see some of the pros and cons and some of the justifications of why this started. In general, the main worry was from the point of view of researchers, of academics, of students. The need for unrestricted access to knowledge generated anywhere in the world. However, when this was started, they realized that they had another argument, which in my point of view is very strong, which is that scientific research is mainly paid by public funds. Therefore, they say that those who pay for science and research should have unrestricted access to the results of those investigations. Then, well, open access makes that easier. And the brief definition, but more complete, of what open access is that anybody, meaning researchers, students, professors, students, and as they say in the Berlin Declaration, anybody who has curiosity can read, download, copy, distribute, print, search, or link to full texts of scientific articles and use them with any legitimate purpose that they might have. Okay, I'm focusing on the articles generated by peer review. But this, in fact, includes everything. Books, papers that are not peer reviewed, thesis, any written knowledge generated by a public institution paid by public funds. Authors have control over the integrity of their work and the right to be adequately recognized and cited. That is not lost at all. In some way, the monopoly of big editorials is eliminated. This is a bit different than, for example, and I'm not going to speak against this, but pirate CDs and movies, because there, when they are not pirate, part of the profit goes to the authors, a minimal part maybe, but it goes to the authors. In the case of articles published by scientists, they never get part of the gains of the editorials. This was an ethical principle of scientists. They were not going to get benefits for publishing. But the editorials were charging, were getting money, and they still get money. And I think that, yes, the monopoly is broken this way. Therefore, now Elsevier has big conflicts with open access. There are other editorials that, in my opinion, have been more intelligent. For example, Nature. They give a timid step. They didn't make their articles open access, but they opened them for reading. You cannot download them, you cannot copy them, but since 2014 they're open for being read, all the magazines published by Nature. From the point of view of researchers, there is another beneficial effect, which is that there is more visibility and more impact if one publishes in open access journals. You're going to be cited more, because we all prefer to use journals which are open access rather than the journals that we have to pay for, so we cite more open access journals. Okay, there is already data. There has been more than 15 years with this open access publications, and it's quite clear that there is a lot more impact when you publish in open access. There's a journal in my area, well, in reality it's more of a general journal of several areas, which is the journal where the American Society of Sciences publishes, PNAS. Since internet exists, this journal is open access. PNAS is way more cited than other equivalent journals, just because it's open access. also a problem that we see apart from this thing about paying for publishing because we have no choice, because our research is not so good, is that in Mexico, the expenses are on the researchers. A researcher has to find a way to pay for publishing the article. But well, international experience is that not. And this is changing a bit in Mexico, although there is not a public policy in Mexico regarding this. But in many countries there is. In the US, in Great Britain, in Europe in general, in the Nordic countries, the ones paying for the expenses of publishing are the institutions who hire the researcher or coming from public subventions. Even though they don't tell you that this is the money for paying, there is some money for paying for publication expenses. As I say, the big difference is that in Mexico, this does not exist as a public policy. One has to find out whether you can and ask the head of research, okay, if I can publish this in open access, will they pay for this? Okay, I don't know, but I will check. Okay, how many publications per year I can publish in open access? But there's apparently no limit, but there's not a policy on this. So one of the negative aspects is that this can be perverted into a model in which you pay for publishing regardless of the quality. Okay, I pay for publishing. If the editorial only cares about receiving my money, then they will accept the article, even if it's rubbish. Although, in principle, the peer review model is maintained. Yep, everything can be perverted. That's a fact. The point is that you can also... There are several ways to avoid this. There are some people that say, okay, one should pay for the peer review. Okay, pay for the review, not for the publication. And the other is that, okay, let's do a follow-up of journals. And believe it or not, there's a website on the internet where you can see which journals have a bad name. Magazines that are suspiciously accepting anything for publication. Okay, then the problem here is maybe... Okay, you can clearly pervert this. The peer review model can be perverted. But then we have to check this and not necessarily the open access model. Okay, well, yes or no? Okay, I, up to now, believe that yes. 2 years ago, no way I said that. Open access, no way. Now I think yes. I was convinced that this is a way that those who do research have unrestricted access to results. The title of my talk was... In order to be able, you have to know. And if we are in a position of generating a small crack on the wall, I think it's very important to know, having access to the knowledge that has been generated. Then this open access, I think it's a possibility to generate a small crack, that all of our students can access articles freely, and those who are not students but are curious can also access. There are cases well documented by Hollywood of parents with kids with strange diseases that started studying and that have managed to improve the life quality of their kids because they went to study science, just because of the interest for their kids. So if there is open access, this is more open. And I think it's also very important because of a different problem that we have now, and that somebody said that it was also an interesting topic to talk about, which is that non-scientific thought is winning the battle. So I think that the more access we have to information, to scientific information, we'll be able to counter the strength of non-scientific thinking, and at least be able to question and to research whether it's true that bananas cause cancer, as it was circulating in Facebook 3 years ago. Okay, well, then I think yes. And above all, I am very pragmatic, so I'm always thinking, okay, what I'm going to do now? So what I'm going to do is tell everybody what open access really is, how it works, what its advantages, disadvantages, and try to accelerate that Mexico has a public policy and that we have these public repositories. I have the advantage that I work in the Autonomous University of Mexico City, and I think there it could be relatively easy to propose that we generate a public repository of the research done in the university. And above all, open this to discussion. Open this to discussion that everybody can at least think about it, and they can start to think ahead of the possible negative consequences of this and start solving. Probably it's a better option to have public repositories than public access journals, but we have to see. The thing is, I think it's very important to whatever we generate, little or much, with your taxes, that you can read it without restrictions. Thank you very much.